السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله، نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره، ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا. من يحده الله فلا مضل له، ومن يضلل فلا هادي له. وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. أما بعد، فإن أحسن الكلام كلام الله، خير الهدى هدى محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم، وإن شر الأمور محدثاتها، وكل محدثة بدعة، وكل بدعة ضلالة، وكل ضلالة في النار. So our lesson today, inshallah, is some advice relating to a person who is involved in making da'wah to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and how he responds and how he behaves to the circumstances that he might find himself in relation to his family and in relation to the society that he lives in. And the basis of the advice today is taken from an answer that was given by Shaykh Salih al-Sheikh Hafizahullah in relation to a very, very important question. And when you think about this question is a very deep question, which can only be answered by an alim who is able to relate the affairs of Tawheed and the affairs of Allah's names and attributes and the affairs of the Qada and Qadr of Allah and the affairs of the wisdoms of Allah in His creation. An answer which incorporates all of these affairs in making a person understand how to look and how to evaluate what is happening around him. So we'll first of all read the question. This is from a lecture from last year, about 6-7 months back. And pay attention to the actual question. So the question is, the question that he basically says, in general the topic is, أَيْنَ عُلَمَاؤُنَا مِنَ الْمُنْكَرَاتِ الَّتِي تَحْصُلُ وَمَا هُوَ تَوْجِيهُكُمْ لِلْدُعَاتِ. General, the question is about where are the scholars in respect to the evils that we see which are taking place around us. And this question is in relation to Saudi Arabia. So keep that in mind. Right? So the person is asking the question, where are the scholars in relation to all of these evils which are taking place? And what is your advice to the du'at? That's a general summary of the question. But as for the specific text of the question, then the questioner, he says, السائل لا يخفى على شريف علمك شيخنا أن الطالب ينتظر فعل شيخه كما ينتظر الطفل فعل أبيه. He first of all says, it is not hidden upon from your knowledge, O our Shaykh, that the student of knowledge, he waits and he watches and he looks at the action of his Shaykh. Just like a child, he watches and he waits for the action of his father. So the relationship between a student with his Shaykh is similar to the son of the child with its father. There are some situations that arise where the child, he is not equipped to deal with that situation. So he stops and he's looking, what's my father going to do? So in a similar manner, there are many situations that a talibul ilm finds himself in, or a da'iyah finds himself in, where he has to halt and he has to look, what are the scholars going to do? What are the scholars going to say? The one who's asking this question is a very, very intelligent person. The question, you can tell the intelligence of a person from the question he's asking. So the questioner begins by making this point. He says, وَنَحْنُ فِي هَذِهِ الْفَطْرَةَ لَا سِيَمَا فِي الدَّمَامِ وَالْخُبَرِ. He says that we, especially in this time of ours, in these places like الدَّمَامِ, الْخُبَرِ, this is going in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, we are seeing an increase of these events where we have these entertainment events, where we have singers, we have free mixing, and other similar types of other similar types of affairs. So he says that the question that we are du'as, we are calling to Allah, and we are mubtadi'een, we are beginners in the path. Now we are starting out in the path of calling people to Allah. And I want to ask you something about this. He says, هَلْ يَحِقُّ لَنَا أَن نَتَسَاءَلَ كَمَا يَتَسَاءَلُ الْمَرِيدُ عَنِ الطَّبِيبِ أَيْنَ الطَّبِيبِ. So this person is asking, do we have the right to ask this question? We are seeing all of these evils taking place around us in our society. Do we have the right to ask the question? Just like the sick person, he asks the question, where is the doctor? He clearly has the right to ask that question. I'm ill, where is the doctor? So in a similar manner, do we as du'at, as callers to Allah, do we have the right to ask as well? Basically what he's saying is, where are our scholars? Where's the scholars? Do we have the right to ask this question? Can a student of knowledge, can he say, where are our scholars in relation to these events or these, you know, things which are happening, and they're happening very, very quickly, and they are very, very disturbing to us? How can we, you know, do we have the right to ask this question? And then the questioner continues. He says that when one of the singers comes, or one of the artists comes, we see that the roads are closed, and, you know, perhaps someone from your own household, right? You are not able to stop that person from going to these events, right? They want to go to these events. And if that person is someone who hasn't been guided by Allah Azza wa Jal, right, how are we, they are our family members, how are we supposed to, what are we supposed to do? Because, you know, these are things that people want to go and see, and want to go and experience. So how are we supposed to, what are we supposed to do? And so, the questioner is saying, what is your advice regarding this for us as people who are du'at? So if you stop and reflect upon this question, you see there are many, many issues that come out of this question. And from those issues that come out of this question is the issue of the scholars, the issue of the rulers, the issue of the du'at, the callers to Allah, the issue of your family, the situation of your family and individual members of your family, and they might be put to trial by way of sins and, you know, things of this nature. Likewise, in terms of da'wah, how do you, as someone who calls to Allah, how are you supposed to understand all of these different scenarios? Right? So there are many, many important things that come out of this very important question. At the same time, there are also many shubuhat that can be addressed by the answer to this question. The shubuhat of the khawarij, for example, because this is now a field in which the khawarij can come and enter. And they look at these things and they can now start using rhetoric and emotion to basically, you know, to push their doctrine and their methodology. And likewise, there's other issues of aqidah come into this as well, to do with Allah's actions and the wisdom behind Allah's actions. So this scenario which the questioner has described, there are many, many, many important lessons that can be taken out of this scenario, which we can use and take and benefit from to benefit in da'wah. And so we see that the Shaykh is going to answer this question with some deep insight into this issue, and it will give us, you know, a good, firm understanding in how we ought to behave. How do we behave in relation to these scenarios which are happening around us? We see it happening in our societies and in Muslim societies. So we have to look at this in the correct way and in the right way. So the Shaykh then begins his answer, and he says, I'll read the text first of all. أولاً, first of all, لا بد أن تعرف أو أن تعرف شيء مهم جدا في فعل الله جل وعلا. الله سبحانه وتعالى في حياة الناس يبتلي العبد بطاعة ومعصية ويبتلي المجتمعات بطاعة ومعصية ويبتلي الناس بإقبال دين وبضعفه. So he says, first of all, the first thing we have to understand, which is very important, is that we have to look at the action of Allah. What we see is the action of Allah in what He does to people in their lives. So Allah Azza wa Jal, He will put an individual servant to trial. He'll put the individual person to trial. He will put him to trial by actions of obedience and actions of disobedience. So this now is something that each one of us we can relate to. Every individual knows from his own self that in whatever he falls into of obedience and disobedience, this is the trial that Allah Azza wa Jal is which Allah Azza wa Jal is putting him through. He's being put to trial by ta'ah and ma'asiyah. Everyone knows from his own experience that this is what takes place with respect to himself on a daily basis. Likewise, Allah Azza wa Jal, He puts societies to test. So now there are types of tests that go beyond you as an individual. Societies, meaning collections of families, they are put to test and put under trial. There are things which don't just affect you as an individual. It could be, for example, poverty. Poverty is affecting a society as a whole. It's not just you as an individual, right? So there are some situations which affect you as an individual in your personal life. There are some situations which are wider and they affect a society. And there are some affairs which affect people in general. It could be a whole nation. It could be a whole society. And in some times, people might be turning towards the religion. At other times, they might be weak in their religion. Right? You see that different states pass upon individuals, societies and whole nations. So for example, if you look at the last century, you see that there was a time when a lot of the areas that were ruled by the Ottoman Empire, they were, you know, generally upon Islam. And then with the spread of communism, then a lot of those nations and societies, they were affected by atheism. So the deen basically disappeared from their societies pretty much. Right? So these are things which take place in societies, and this is part and parcel of Allah testing societies. Right? Testing them by obedience in some state, in some situations, and testing them by disobedience in other situations. So he says that Allah Azza wa Jalla, so basically what we need to do first of all, the point that the Shaykh is making is first of all, we have to look at these affairs purely from the angle that this is the action of Allah Azza wa Jal in His creation, and what is the wisdom, what is the reason behind these actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. We have to first of all understand it from this point of view. So then he gives an example. He says, look, for example, that Allah Azza wa Jal, he put people to trial with shirk, and then that trial will end. He will put people to trial with a bid'ah, then that bid'ah will end. And all of these are from the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal, so that whatever wisdoms He has behind these affairs, that those wisdoms are realized. So He says, Allah Azza wa Jal, He says that the servant must reflect and understand that Allah Azza wa Jal, He is someone who yaqbid wa yabsut subhanahu, meaning He is the one who withholds and the one who expands. He is Al-Qabid and He is Al-Basit. These are from the names of Allah Azza wa Jal which go together. So sometimes in the worldly, if we look at just the worldly thing, Allah expands the provision for some people. So you see some people have riches and you know, plenty and things like that, even if they are disbelievers, even if they are polytheists, even if they are disobedient. And there are some people He restricts the provision. Right? He restricts it upon them. And this applies to the dunya, and it also applies to the deen as well. So to some people, he will yabsut, right? He will expand the religion for them in the sense that they acquire iman, the increase in their iman, the increase in their righteous actions, right? Allah confers this upon a people. He expands them, gives them increase in iman. And you see this in certain nations. You see, for example, in the Gulf countries, in Saudi Arabia, you see there is tawheed, you see there is khair, you see there is Quran, there is adhan, there is salah, there is masajid. All of this is, you know, this is Allah, you know, increase, giving increase. And in other places we see there is qabd, there is restriction and you know, limiting that iman. All of these are from the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. He is al-qabid and he is al-basit. And this applies to the dunya, the physical material affairs. It also applies to the affairs of iman, to the affairs of the deen. Right? This is similar to what the scholars say about the ayah in the Quran. يخرج الحي من الميت ويخرج الميت من الحي. That Allah is the one who brings out the living from the dead, and He brings out the dead from the living. This applies both in terms of the dunya, so we see around us that the earth is dead, and He brings it to life by way of the rain, and the vegetation appears. And likewise the other way around, you see the vegetation and everything else, and then Allah causes it to die. He brings out the dead from the living. This is a cycle that's always taking place. We see it all around us, year in, year out. We see these cycles. In a similar manner, this also applies to the hearts of people. There are some hearts, Allah puts life into those hearts and brings them out from their death. And meaning He puts iman into a heart that was upon kufr. It was dead, now it has been brought to life by the water of revelation. And likewise, the other way around, you see hearts which were living, or they had something of life, and then Allah causes them to die. Right? So these are people who are engaged in persistent upon sin, or people who fall into ridda, apostasy. Right? Their hearts are caused to die. So here we are looking at all of these things from the angle of the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. These are the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. And Allah Azza wa Jal, He is doing this for a reason. He's doing this for a wisdom. He is doing this in order to test mankind, to put them to trial. And this we find, if we look at history now, if we look at history of man in general, then we can look at the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. So for example, in the time of Nuh alayhi salam, the first 10 generations were upon Tawheed. And then it was from the action of Allah Azza wa Jal that shirk should take place. And the people in that time were very small in number. Right? There weren't billions of people that you see today. Those people were they were small in number. There were only 10 generations. So you can imagine that the number of people would have been very, very small. But Allah willed to put those people to trial. They were put to trial with Shirk al-Akbar. They began to worship righteous people and set up, you know, representations and idols and statues. And so Shirk came, and the first messenger was sent to those people. He lived amongst them for 1,000 years, minus 50. And none accepted his message except a very small number of people. Tiny number of people. And so this is something that Allah willed to happen. And Allah allowed Shirk to happen. Why did He do this? In order to test the people, to put the people to trial. So this is the first point that the Shaykh is making, is that first thing that we do is we look at whatever is happening from the point of view of the action of Allah Azza wa Jal amongst His servants. What benefit do we take from this? How is this relevant to me and you and to our families? And to our societies, well, we look at the calamities that we face as individuals. You might have calamities and hardships in the household, you as an individual, with your family, with your children, with your relatives, right, or in the society that you live in. So the first thing that you do, you look at this from the angle of the action of Allah Azza wa Jal in putting you to trial. You see the action of, this is what you see first, you see the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. You don't see, for example, a disobedient child, or a disobedient wife, or a family member who's engaged in sin, or who's engaged in oppression. You don't see that first. What you see first is the action of Allah Azza wa Jal, and what is Allah intending, what is the purpose behind the situation that Allah has put me, has made me to face. That's the first thing that you look at, and that's what the Shaykh is basically drawing our attention to. So, from this angle, there's a connected issue now that we'll very quickly touch upon. So the first thing that we should be clear now is that in relation to all these situations, the first thing that we do is we look at it from the angle of the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. This now brings us to a connected issue in our aqeedah, which is, are there reasons and are there wisdoms behind the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal? Does somebody want to answer this question? Are there reasons and are there wisdoms behind the actions of Allah, or are they just, there's nothing behind them? What's the answer? What's our belief in relation to this question? Huh? There are reasons? Okay. And there are wisdoms. So the question that we asked is, are there reasons, are there wisdoms behind the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal? Because the first thing that the Shaykh has brought our attention to is that we must, first of all, see the action of Allah, that this is the action of Allah in His creation. And so this leads us to a related issue in our aqeedah. Are there reasons, are there wisdoms behind the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal? And so as you explained, as you answered, that yes, there are reasons, there are wisdoms in the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. And this is what is the belief of Ahlu Sunnati wal Jama'ah. This subject is known as Al-Hikmah wa Ta'leel fi Af'alillah. Al-Hikmah wa Ta'leel fi Af'alillah. Which means the issue of there being wisdoms and there being reasons behind the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. So there were some people who basically say that the actions of Allah, there is no reason behind it, nor is there any wisdom behind it. It's just totally neutral. Allah just acts. Allah's actions just take place. You can't say that there was a reason behind it, nor can you say that there was actually a wisdom behind it. Right? And this is said by the people of Jabr, the people who are the Jabariyya, people like the Jahmiyya, the Ash'aris, and likewise it's said by many of the Sufis, and likewise it's said by, it was said by Ibn Hazm, the Zahiriyya. They basically say that Allah's actions, we can't say there's a reason behind them or there is a wisdom behind them. And this is false. This is a false belief. Rather, Allah Azza wa Jal, His actions, we find in the Quran and the Sunnah, many, many examples of how or of when Allah Azza wa Jal, He mentions that something has been done for a reason. Something has a illah, has a reason behind it. And likewise, there is a wisdom that follows it as well. To give you an example, to illustrate this point, we see in the ayah, ظَهَرَ الْفَسَادُ فِي الْبَرِّ وَالْبَحْرِ بِمَا كَسَبَتْ عَيْدِ النَّاسِ لِيُذِيقَهُمْ بَعْدَ الَّذِي عَمِلُوا لَعَلَّهُمْ يَرْجِعُونَ. Mischief or corruption has appeared upon the sea and the land, or the land and the sea, because of what the hands of men have earned, in order that he may give them a taste of what the hands of men have earned, and in order that they may return. So here we see that when there is corruption in the society, when there is evil in the society, what caused that? Why did Allah cause that? Why did Allah allow that? It is because the hands of men, they earned evil, they committed sins. Right? And so Allah's action is that there will be corruption and harm in the society. So this is now the reason. What is the wisdom behind that? The wisdom is in order that they may return back to the truth. So they taste the punishment and the harm of their actions, so they realize, and then they return back to the truth. So here's a clear example of a reason behind Allah's action, and likewise a wisdom behind Allah's action. So what we say as people of the Sunnah, we believe that in all of the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal, there is wisdom, and there are far-reaching wisdoms. And that's why you see Ibn al-Qayyim, rahimahullah ta'ala, he said in one of his books, Shifa'ul Alil, He says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Hakim. He is all wise. And la yaf'alu shay'an abathan. He does not do anything which is vain. Abath, which is just, which has no purpose. Wala lighayri ma'na wa maslaha. Nor does he do anything which doesn't have any meaning or which doesn't have any benefit and doesn't have any hikmah, wisdom, which is the reason why he did it. Rather, the actions of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, all of his actions, they emanate from his wisdom. There's a wisdom behind him doing what he did. And this is indicated by his own speech in the Quran and the speech of his messenger. And there are so many places, so many evidences that they cannot even be enumerated. So the point being that we as people of the Sunnah, we believe that all of the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal, that there are wisdoms and there are meanings and there are benefits behind his actions. None of his actions are in vain or in jest or without reason, without purpose. And this is our belief. This opposes the belief of the philosophers and the Jahmiya. They basically say that whatever takes place in the creation, you know, we can't say, yes, Allah, that there was this wisdom or there was this reason. All of it is just totally neutral. Things just happen. And we can't ascribe to Allah anything. That he had a wisdom in this. That he had a reason behind this. And all of this, you know, is completely false. It's completely false. Rather, there are reasons why things take place in Allah's creation. One of the best examples we can give is, I'm sure all of you have heard of the hadith about the five things where the Messenger of Allah, he advised the Muhajireen, and he said to them, oh, gathering of the Muhajireen, there are five things you should seek refuge, that you should be alive when they, you know, that they reach you. Then he went on to mention those five things, right? So in these five things, never do the people engage in open, illicit, you know, shameful deeds, except that they will have diseases which their forefathers never experienced before. And likewise, never did the people cheat in the weights and measures amongst themselves, except that they will be afflicted with years of hardship, with famine, and the tyranny of the ruler upon them. So when you look at these hadith, and you know, these examples in the Quran and the Sunnah, you see that things happen for a reason. Right? So why does Allah Azza wa Jal cause diseases to spread amongst the people? Right? It's because these effects have a cause behind them, right? Allah made it to happen because there's a reason behind it, because of the people and what they do. Why do people have tyrannical rulers? Because there's a reason behind it. So everything in the creation of Allah, there are asbab, there are ways and means, there are causes and effects. And Allah does things for a wisdom, for a reason. Now, the point behind all of this is that when we start understanding and we start looking at the evils in society from this point of view, then we gain wisdom about what is going on, right? And therefore, we will not fall into the same thing that, for example, the Khawarij will fall into, right? The Khawarij, as you know, they are juhal, they are ignorant people. They have no understanding of the affairs of Aqidah. They have no understanding of the al-qada wal-qadr. They don't return back to the scholars. They don't return issues back to the scholars. So the only things they see evil rulers. Sin. Right? And behind all of that, they can't see anything else. They can't see what we are discussing right here. They can't see the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. They can't see that these calamities where you have tyrannical rulers is because there is something that the people themselves are doing. There's something that the people are doing which has led to tyrannical evil rulers oppressing them, right? It is that they are cheating, they are deceiving themselves and cheating themselves. So a rule in Allah's creation is he puts these rulers over them. So the Khariji, the person who is from the Khawarij, he only sees the action of the ruler. That's the only thing he sees. Right? Just like the example I gave to you in your personal life, you might see, for example, you have a disobedient child, or a disobedient wife, or a sinful husband, or something like that. So the only thing you are looking at is just that wife, or that husband, or that child. This is from your jahl. Because you need to first of all see the action of Allah Azza wa Jal, and what Allah Azza wa Jal, what is the wisdom and the what's happening here in your household? Right? Then you look at the actual action of the wife or the husband or the child. So in a similar manner, the Khawarij, what they are doing is they see that one thing, what the ruler is doing, and the sin and the ma'asi and whatever else is taking place in society, but behind that there is nothing else. There is no fiqh, there is no basira, and so that's why these people, they are led astray and they become misguided. So the point that the Shaykh is informing us here is that behind the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal, there are reasons and there are wisdoms. And by, you know, this is part and parcel of our belief. When we understand this, then we have a better grasp of reality. We have a better grasp of what is going on in my personal life. What is going on in my family and the people around me. What is going on in the society I live in, and what is happening in nations, what is happening in the world, right? You gain basira about all of these things. So the Shaykh says that the student of knowledge, the first thing that he does, so the first thing that he looks at is he sees the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. That's one way to look at the issue. There are actually a number of issues that we do. The second issue, obviously, this goes without saying, the second issue now that the Talib al-Ilm has to do is that he has to show rejection against the munkar. You make inkar of the munkar in your heart. And this is something that everybody has to do, right? You hate it in your heart. Whatever you're able to change of the munkar, you do that in your family, in your household. And all of this is very clear. We don't need to expand any further, you know, in all of this. So far, we have explained that when we look at the evils, we first of all look at the action of Allah in allowing these evils. And secondly, we understand that this is from the al-ibtila al-kawni. This is the worldly test that Allah Azza wa Jal puts people through, and the reason or the purpose behind it is liyabluwakum ayyukum ahsanu amala. That he may test you which of you is best indeed. So here now is the reason and the wisdoms that follow on from that. So why are you as an individual, why is it that obedience and disobedience is coming to you? Why are you being put through these situations? Why is it that families and societies are put through obedience and disobedience? Why is it that the shirk occurs? Why is it that bid'ah occurs? Why is it that kufr occurs? Why are all these things happening? All of these are from the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal, because it is a means by which the one who is the best in action can be distinguished from the one who is not like that. Right? So this is the second thing that the Shaykh is saying, that this ibtila, Allah will put the people to trial, Allah will put the societies to trial, Allah will put whole nations to trial. And so therefore we have to keep looking at what is the wisdom, all of the events, everything which is taking place, there is a wisdom behind everything. Allah intends a wisdom. We might always see that, we might not always see that wisdom, but there is a wisdom behind all of that. So, once this point is clear, then the Shaykh saying, so therefore we have to now look at affairs from the angle of the Sharia and from the angle of knowledge. This is how we look at things. So from here he moves on, he says, coming back now to the question that the questioner he asked at the very beginning, he says, now when you look and you ask this question, how have the affairs changed so quickly that all of a sudden, in a land where there is Tawheed, things have changed very, very quickly. How has this happened? Right, for the people who weren't here at the beginning of the lesson, this advice is taken from a question and answer in which Sheikh Saleh Ali Sheikh was asked a question about a situation that's happening in Saudi Arabia, about the presence of evils, about the spread of, you know, music events, things like that, and the fact that there are individuals within families who are wanting to attend these events. How are we supposed to deal with this situation? How are we supposed to deal with, you know, what's happening in the scholars and the rulers? Right? This is a general question that was put to the Sheikh. And so the Sheikh, first of all, the point he made was that, first of all, we have to look at this from the angle that these are from the actions of Allah. There are wisdoms in the actions of Allah. Allah puts individuals, societies and whole nations to test, right? In history you see, there are times when Allah put nations to test with shirk. Then he erased that shirk and brought tawheed. Then he brought shirk again and erased that shirk. Right? These are patterns that take place recurringly because there are wisdoms behind this. And the wisdoms behind this is to put people to trial, to see who is best indeed, to distinguish the people of paradise from the people of hellfire. So all of this is basically taking place. So now the Shaykh is leading on to the, you know, to answer the question, which is, we have to stop and think, how can it be that the situation has changed so quickly and so suddenly where there are people in the land of Tawheed who are drawn towards, you know, entertainment and music and things like that? You know, how does this happen? What is the wisdom behind all of this? And how does this basically happen? And how do you reach the situation where, for example, you know, within a single family, you see that there will be family problems, a person's father dies and all of the family splits and starts having arguments. Why has this happened all of a sudden? How come it wasn't there before? How can it be all of a sudden that you realize, hang on, your family members are wanting to go and, you know, listen to music and want to go and attend these events? Again, he's speaking in Saudi Arabia now, right? How can this all of a sudden happen out of the blue? Where has this come from all of a sudden? And so he's basically saying that we have to understand there are reasons why this happens, and this is because the absence of tarbiyah, a weak tarbiyah that we'll come and look at later on, inshallah ta'ala. And then the next thing he goes on to mention is that many people, because of the weakness of da'wah, and because people are being neglected, you see that these people are starting to turn towards these affairs because there's no tarbiyah in the house. And then he says also that in fact, before we go further, we should explain that there are many affairs that never used to exist before that are putting people to trial, which is the reason why all of a sudden you suddenly discover that a person is inclined towards this way. So number one, you see that because of social media, because of the internet, because of YouTube, you see many people have become role models, right? So for example, you have a daughter, and your daughter is watching, you know, these hijabi fashion, you know, people who are out there, you know, teaching hijab fashion, which doesn't even make sense, because it contradicts the whole spirit of hijab, right? So these are impressionable young girls. So they start watching and looking, and these people who are behind this, what they are really doing is they see in all of this a means of making money. Right? They realize there's a huge audience, especially those who are teenagers, are very impressionable, very young. And, you know, because they're very young and impressionable, they're drawn to these types of things. So they build a huge following, right? They'll build 100,000 followers, 500,000 followers, right? All in the name of the religion. This is all in the name of the deen. At the beginning, it will be all religious, an Islamic identity. And as you go further and further and further and further, you find that the true colors start to appear in these people, right? So over time, the hijab slowly starts to disappear. Over time, they start introducing other, you know, corrupt things and, you know, pranks and this and whatever. Because what these people realize is that this is a way to actually make money. This is a way to achieve status. The shaitan plays with these individuals, right? And through these individuals, they misguide the hundreds of thousands that are basically attached to them. So this is taking place, and the parent is heedless. You don't know what's going on. You think, oh, it's just some nice tarbiyah and, you know, whatever else. And then all of a sudden, you're faced with a situation where you find that your child or your daughter or whatever, you know, you find that they say, oh, I don't really want to wear the hijab anymore. And you think, where has this come from? Or you find that, you know, some other habit appears out of the blue, and you think, huh, where did this come from? Right? So what the Shaykh is saying here, that these kind of issues that you are faced with as individuals, first of all, obviously, it's the action of Allah. But secondly, there's got to be reasons behind why this has happened. And the reason is because of a weak tarbiyah. There is lack of tarbiyah. You haven't taken the time. You don't just say, you know, you say, do not do this, do not do this. And the reason is because of this. Do you understand? There's a difference between saying to your children, "La, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this," telling them do's and don'ts. Right? But you have to explain to them, you can't do this because such and such. You explain to them the wisdom behind why are you wearing hijab? Why are you establishing the 5 daily prayers? Right? What is the what's the benefit in you doing that? And you explain it in relation to Tawheed. Why is it that you need that you can't listen to music and so on and so forth? Why? Right? So the Shaykh says here that this tarbiyah, you make them attached to the Quran, you make them attached to the Adhkar, you actually tell them what is hijab, what are the conditions, what is the reason why, right? You have to explain all of these things. And when this tarbiyah is absent and not present, then you will be facing trials in your family. These trials will come to you and they will hit you in your family because of the absence of this tarbiyah. So he says that when we try to solve these problems of the family, we have to bring all of these considerations together. Number one, it's the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. Number two, there are wisdoms behind what is taking place. Number three, we can't accept the situation, we can't accept the munkar, we have to treat it and deal with it. How do we treat it and deal with it? We have to understand what are the reasons and causes. Right? The reasons and causes are neglect, first of all. On our behalf, we are neglectful. We do not understand the environment that we are living in and the evils and the pressures and the influence that is coming from the environment to us, to our families, to our children, and so on and so forth. So once all of this is clear, now we need to move on and address the issue of the scholars. Because remember, the person who asked the question, he said, why are the scholars silent? Why aren't the scholars speaking? Right? This is in the context of what's happening in over there, of, you know, entertainment and cinemas and this and whatever. So the Shaykh gives a very, very great answer. He says that no doubt that Allah Azza wa Jal has placed a burden upon the shoulders of the scholars to establish the wajib. And it is not a condition upon the scholars that the people are affected by what they say. Right? Do you understand? The scholars will do the wajib that is upon them, but it's not a condition for us to expect that everyone's going to listen to them. If the alim has come out and expressed his rejection of that evil, right, he has fulfilled his obligation. Whether he does it once, whether he does it twice, whether he does it 5 times, right, he has fulfilled his obligation. And the fact that the people do not respond and do not listen to him, that is not to blame upon the scholar. And that's why we read in the ayat in the Quran with respect to the messengers of Allah, for example, وَمَا عَلَيْنَا إِلَّا الْبَلَاغُ الْمُبِينَ. It is only upon us to make the plain conveyance to you. It is not in our hands if you respond or not. And similarly, رُسُلًا مُبَشِّرِينَ وَمُنذِرِينَ لِأَلَّا يَكُونَ لِلنَّاسِ عَلَى اللَّهِ هُجَّةٌ بَعْدَ الرَّسُلِ. We sent the messengers as those who give glad tidings and who warn, so that the people will not have any proof against Allah after the messengers have been sent. So in a similar manner, the scholars, when they show rejection to the evil and they clarify to the people, then it is not a condition that the people have to respond to them for us to believe that they fulfill the wajib. No. This is what the way the Khawarij think, because they don't understand all these affairs that we are discussing. Right? So the Shaykh then goes on to say, when you look at the youth today, you see the youth, they are confused. And they are mixed. And you see that they are very, very far away from the tarbiyah of the religion, from the language of religion, and from ilm. And when you go to the shabab and you mix with them, you'll see that they'll have something of the deen, but also you'll see them mixed up in maybe some entertainment, right? It'll be they're into gaming, for example, or they're into some sort of music, or they're into some sort of, you know, sport fascination, or they're into something, right? This is just the nature
The youth want this thing. The youth are after this type of thing. And why is this? The Shaykh goes on to explain that this is something, in these times, it is a trial that Allah has brought to the whole of the world. What is this trial? It is the trial of Western atheism. This is what the Shaykh says, Western atheism, and this materialism seeking after the dunya, and this being spread across the whole of the world by way of satellite TV and by way of the internet. Right? Remember we said at the beginning that there are certain times in which Allah puts nations to trial, or whole societies to trial. So what the Shaykh is saying here, that right now in the 21st century, this is from the action of Allah in putting Muslim nations to trial by way of this fitna. Right? This fitna is something that no ruler and no scholar is able to prevent. Right? You have to understand the answer of the Shaykh. He's basically saying that there are times in which, you know, it is from the decree of Allah that He is going to put that nation to trial. And that action of Allah is greater and goes beyond what any individual ruler, what any individual scholar can actually do or repel. In fact, groups of scholars can't repel it. Why? Because this is now Allah Azza wa Jalla testing a people. He's testing the subjects of the whole of that nation. So anyone who was upon Iman, he feared Allah, he benefited from his Iman, he kept away from the evil, right? When this fitna now comes and envelopes that nation, that person will be safe. That person will not be affected by this fitna, right? So that's why in those societies, in the Gulf countries, all of those who for the past few decades, they were upon Iman, they give their children tarbiyah, they are the ones who will be protected from this fitna now that it has come. And all of those people who were not like that, you know, they're just following rituals and customs and didn't understand the deen, right? The hearts are really empty of fiqh and basira. They didn't have tarbiyah. And they are the people who will be put to trial by this thing which has now come, right? So what the Shaykh is saying is that this issue goes beyond the rulers. It goes beyond the scholars. Right, it is something that we can see clearly. It is the action of Allah in testing whole nations. And he's saying that the key underlying thing here is the westernization, is basically taghrib and ilhad. It is westernization and it is atheism that is being pushed. Now this fitna has actually come to the Muslim nations. And this is from the qadr of Allah. This is a test, just like the people of Nuh were put through test by way of shirk. Or how, for example, the Muslim nation was put to test by way of Greek philosophy and ilmul kalam, right? And all of the groups of the Jahmiyyah, right? This is the same thing that's happening. This is what's happening now. And you see that why is this so powerful that no one can do anything? It is so powerful because the means of communication, the Shaykh mentions all these things. He says you have Facebook, you have Twitter, you have YouTube, you have this social media. It is beyond the power and control of any nation. Even non-Muslim nations. You see, non-Muslim nations, they are scared about the effect of social media upon the politics, upon morals, upon whatever, and they are trying to manipulate and control whatever they can because they know it can lead to tremendous harms. So they will use the power of social media to instigate revolutions, for example, in the Muslim lands. But they'll try and control it and manipulate it and censor it when it comes to their own countries. And they won't allow, you know, this revolution and things like that to happen in their own countries. So this is something that is very big. It's beyond the control of any nation, any one ruler, any group of scholars. And this, we look at it from the point of view as being the action of Allah in putting people to trial. So the point that we understand is that this wave that is coming, that Allah has allowed to be unleashed, all of it is based upon atheism and materialism. That's what the Shaykh is saying. And all of it calls to disobedience. All of it calls to following whims and following desires. This is happening on a huge scale. So the point that the Shaykh is saying, there will be some people who might be in your family, they are put to trial, right? So you have to look at the situation from all of these angles. Number one, it is the action of Allah. Number two, don't start blaming the rulers and the scholars, right? Because this thing is greater and beyond the rulers and the scholars. Number three, where was the tarbiyah in your home? Where was the tarbiyah that you were supposed to having in your home? Right, now that this fitna has come and there are people who are affected, now why are you saying, you know, you should have been tarbiyah so that a person was immune and protected from being affected by this fitna when it came? Number three. Number four, what is this fitna? Basically, it is this taghrib and ilhad, which is being pushed upon all of the societies. And number four, it is all pervasive and so powerful, social media. No one can really escape it, right? So the Shaykh is alluding to all of these things, and he now leads us to what is the solution? What is the solution? What is the solution to this? The Shaykh says the solution is غَرْسُ iman fin nufus. How do we solve all of these problems? Which Yahuji says, it is to plant firmly iman into the hearts. Firmly planting iman into the hearts. He says, this is known by experience. This is the quickest and the shortest route, known from experience, to protect yourself and your family and the nation from trials and tribulations. How do we plant iman firmly? You know, we teach our children about paradise and hellfire, and we teach them these realities, we make them attached to the Quran. You know, we plant it firmly in our children. And obviously this is a topic in and of itself, but the affairs of iman, iman in Allah and the angels and the books and the messengers and the last day and al-qadr, right, we plant this firmly in the hearts of our children, and we return back to these affairs and we make sure that the hearts are firmly upon these things. And so then the Shaykh finishes by saying, he says, لَا تَتَسَاهَلُونَ بِانْتِشَارِ الْإِلْحَادِ لَا تَتَسَاهَلُونَ بِانْتِشَارِ الْإِلْحَادِ. He says, do not take it lightly with the spread of atheism. Do not take this matter lightly. Do not take this matter lightly. He says, you will see this ilhad, whether it is ilhad an-nafi, or ilhad shak, meaning whether it is atheism or agnosticism. You see it widespread. It is spread everywhere. He says, it is lazim ta'rifuna hadhihi al-mushkila. It is law-binding that you recognize this problem, that this spread of ilhad. If you look in the world, in the Muslim world today, you see there are two main areas where atheism is growing quite quickly. One is in Pakistan and one is in Egypt. And there are reasons behind this. If you look at both of these countries, you will see that historically speaking, the colonialists had a presence in these countries. So from Pakistan, for example, that was the place where the rejection of the Hadith movement, this is where it began. Right? The Quran only, and we reject the Hadith. Right. These people like the Parways and those people, they were affected by Western ideas. And, and so they came out with this idea of rejection of the Sunnah and modernism and so on and so forth. And that's why you see that many of the educated elite from that country, they will be prone towards, you know, atheism and modernism. So that movement is coming out of there very, very strongly. And likewise in Egypt, historically, you had the likes of Muhammad Abdo, Jamaluddin al-Afghani, the people like that. And they likewise, they were upon this taghrib and, modernization. And you see many, many people coming from there as well. And so these people, as we said, these people are upon jahl with respect to iman and whatever reasons they might have. But we see this thing is happening and it's spreading, and that's why the Shaykh is making this point, that this is spread, and especially amongst the young children, the youth, the men, the girls and the boys, right? They are coming and they are being affected by this thing. Why? Because it's kind of like it's cool to kind of believe that you are so smart, that you don't believe in fairy tales, that you are so, this is the general idea they're putting into the minds of the people, that, you know, it's backward to believe in the Quran and the Sunnah, because science has now proven everything to be wrong. And it is cool to be intelligent and smart, right? They're pushing this idea. So the point that the Sheikh is making, that this is being spread, and it requires positive action. Al-amal al-ijabi. What is the positive action? He says, number one, that we have to spread the evidences for Tawheed, the dalail of Tawheed. When we sit in the mosque, we don't just tell people there is only one Lord, and He deserves to be worshipped, but we establish the evidences from the Qur'an and the Sunnah as to why that is the haqq, why that is the truth. Likewise, we learn the ithbat of Allah's existence, we establish evidences for Allah's existence. We have to bring out these affairs from our books, we have to teach them to the people. He says, you know, we tabsituha linnas, ma'rifatuha, ta'kiduha, that we explain them in our gatherings, we explain the evidence for His existence, we break down the details, we break down the evidences, we emphasize them, we repeat them, until even in the mosque, the Shaykh says, even in the mosque, all of you people, you are believers in Allah. No one denies Allah Azza wa Jal. Even then, you should still come and you explain the evidences and the proofs. Why? Because maybe your child might be in need of it. Maybe you might be in need of it. Even though you're already a believer in Allah Azza wa Jal, right? This is to make ta'keed. This is to make, you know, the, as we said, gharsul iman, to establish iman firmly in the hearts of the people. So the Shaykh basically finishes on this point, and what we'll do, I think we're going to break for salah, and if we can continue maybe for perhaps half an hour afterwards, just to finish off some issues in connection to the topic of atheism. We have some kalam from Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn al-Qayyim, Imam al-Sa'di, just to finish off the topic inshallah ta'ala. But we'll conclude just by rounding off everything that we should have taken from this lesson so far. So number one is that the question is about the challenges of da'wah in your family and society. Situations that you as an individual or you as a caller face in your family and the society around you. And this question was in relation to, you know, some of the evils which are appearing in, you know, some of the Muslim lands. So the first thing that you have to do is you have to look at it from the point of view of the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. This is the action of Allah Azza wa Jal. And Allah Azza wa Jal, He guides, He misguides, He brings trials, sometimes He will allow shirk to spread, other times He will bring iman and tawheed. Other times He will bring kufr, other times He will bring iman. Other times He will bring riches and plenty, other times He will bring poverty and, you know, so on and so forth. These are all the actions of Allah who is engaged in this. These are the actions of Allah. This is the first thing that we have to realize before we start looking at the thing itself. Secondly, we have to understand and realize there are hikam, there are wisdoms behind the actions of Allah. No action of Allah is in vain. No action of Allah is without purpose. No action of Allah is without a wisdom. Whether we realize it or not. In some instances, we are told of the wisdom in the text itself. In many other instances, we might know, we might not understand the wisdom of Allah Azza wa Jal. And this is the second thing that we have to realize. The third thing that we have to realize is, once these two points are clear, is that in our time, there is a trial that we can clearly see that is being brought upon the Muslim lands, which is this issue of taghrib and ilhad. And this is something that is outside the control of the rulers and the scholars, because the means by which it is entering the lives of people is beyond the control of any person, any nation, any government, any individual. This is like social media, the tube and things like that. And so you see, this is really Allah putting the people's hearts to trial. So whichever heart was nurtured upon iman and repel the sins for all of the years gone by, for the decades gone by, those hearts will be safe from this trial. Right? That's why in, say for example, in some of these Gulf countries, you might have seen many of those people, there are masajid, there is the Quran, right? Maybe they didn't pray, maybe they weren't interested, maybe it was just blind following the society that they, that's all they're doing it for. They haven't really been taught that Islam is the haqq and He's the reason why. And here's why Nasraniya is batil, and why Yahudiya is batil, and why La Diniya is batil, right? They haven't been taught, right? They're just memorizing texts without any fahm, without any basira, without any fiqh. And they are lax in their prayers. They are lax in these affairs. Now when the fitna comes and the satellites are open and the internet is open and all of a sudden you start seeing things and you start hearing things and you are unable to repel the shahwa and you are unable to repel the shubha. Right? The shahwa is the desires. And the shubha, when the shubhat come about the Qur'an, about whatever else, you're unable to repel these affairs. Right? So those people who are in that society, like the ulama, the scholars who attend the gatherings of the ulama, who study Kitab al-Tawheed and the evidences, and they understand, they have fahm, they have basira, and then they, you know, make tamassuk to the deen of Allah Azza wa Jal. When this fitna comes, shubha and shahwa, they will be safe and protected. And those who are heedless, spent decades and decades upon heedlessness, those are the people whose hearts the fitna is going to enter. So the point being, this fitna is beyond any ruler, beyond any scholar, right? So we don't agree with what the Khawarij do, where they see only one thing. Look at all these evils in the society. Where are the rulers? Where are the scholars, right? They must be disbelievers because this is from their jahal, because they are juhal. They don't understand these affairs. So then this leads to the question, fourthly, how do we deal with this situation? The situation is the absence of tarbiyah and the weakness of tarbiyah, right? There are things happening in your household as to why people are being affected. You were neglectful. And then finally, the Sheikh went on to, you know, give us the way that we treat this problem is to make iman firmly rooted in the hearts of the people. And by iman, we don't just mean telling them, this is what we believe, and this is halal haram, but we explain to them the evidences and the wisdoms of Allah. We have to bring out these types of evidences from the books of Ibn al-Qayyim, from the books of Ibn Taymiyyah, from the books of the ulama, and give them an understanding of their religion. Not just tell them, you must do this, you must do that, you must do this, but there has to be the understanding behind it as well. What is the wisdom behind not drinking alcohol? What is the wisdom behind behind wearing hijab? In all of these cases, there are wisdoms which are found and which the scholars have explained. So we teach the children so they understand what they are doing, what they are practicing. And not just doing what they are told, and then when they find it's not fashionable, then they rebel. And they've got nothing to fall back upon in terms of understanding and whatever else. That's what the Sheikh basically is saying. And then finally, he brought our attention to this very dangerous affair, which is this issue of at-taghrib, westernization, and ilhad, which is being pushed and which is being affected, that we cannot be lax about this issue. It is a growing issue, becoming bigger and bigger, and we have to deal with this until even in the mosque, as the Sheikh says, we are all believers in Allah, but that does not mean that we should neglect to revise and explain and expound the various evidences for Allah's existence, for His rububiyyah, because this is part and parcel of rooting iman into the hearts of the people. So we'll stop there, we'll stop for the salah, and maybe for just half an hour after the Salatul Asr, we'll continue, inshallah, and try and finish off some of the other materials which are connected to this.
Bismillah, walhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillahi wa ba'd. So just to recap then what we said, we have to understand that we have to always see the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal in what takes place around us, and that there are reasons and wisdoms behind these actions. This allows us to better treat the problems that we find ourselves in, whether it is in relation to our families just from a worldly point of view, or whether it is from the point of view of da'wah itself. And that when we look at it from the point of view of Allah's actions, then we understand that there are reasons and wisdoms behind His actions. And in history, Allah Azza wa Jal, He brings different states and conditions upon a people. Sometimes He will allow shirk to spread, sometimes He will allow iman to spread, sometimes He will allow sunnah to spread, sometimes He will allow bid'ah to spread, sometimes He will allow the deen to be strong, sometimes he will allow it to be weak. In all of these processes, in all of these cycles, there are wisdoms and there are purposes behind all of this. And so from this, we then lead to the issue of what we are witnessing now and experiencing of, you know, this force or this power that is beyond any one individual or nation. And this is the use of the internet and social media and just, you know, things which get right into the private lives of people, right? It's just the nature of technology. And through that, through this medium, all of these are the actions of Allah Azza wa Jal. Through this medium, Allah Azza wa Jal is bringing trial and fitna to the individual and to the society and to the whole nation. And this means that even for the scholars and rulers, there are things which are outside of their control. And it could even be the case that, you know, that Allah Azza wa Jal is bringing trials to that society because that society, that nation has, you know, shown from its history that it is, you know, maybe deserving of being put to trial to test its iman, to see is it really holding fast to, you know, to the deen of Allah, to the rope of Allah, and to distinguish. Because in these countries, as we said, some of these Muslim countries, you are seeing atheists appear, murtadun appear, you know, things like that. And this is a trial for those people. And so this leads us to the issue of the tarbiyah in our homes, and one of the specific types of tarbiyah that we have to ensure that we are doing is to combat this issue of the atheism, because as we said, it is being heavily pushed, heavily promoted, and young people are impressionable, and when they hear all of the, when they access all of this stuff, which, you know, you may not have control over, when they see people ridiculing Islam, ridiculing the Quran, ridiculing the Messenger of Allah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, treating, you know, it to be backward and whatever else, and then these people fear like peer pressure in school or in college or in university. Right? You see, a lot of these people, they're not able to handle that pressure, and they think, you know what? You know, why am I sticking to something which is going to bring me a whole load of problem and ridicule, when, you know, this is how a mind starts thinking of a person, of an individual, and especially a young, impressionable child who doesn't have the means, who doesn't have the tarbiyah, who doesn't have the knowledge and the understanding to be able to address these types of issues. So then they start thinking, oh well, you know, it's cool to be clever and intelligent, right? And they get deceived into thinking that these theories and ideas which are being pushed and promoted, right, that they are the haqq, that they are the undisputable truth, when they are not. So this issue returns back to the issue of tarbiyah. And from that tarbiyah, the Shaykh emphasized at the end that we have to address, we have to bring out these issues of iman in Allah, evidences for His existence, evidences for His rububiyah, and not just suffice just with telling people, not just telling children, but we have to bring out the actual evidences. And these kinds of evidences, we see them in the books of the scholars like Ibn al-Qayyim, Ibn Taymiyyah, Imam al-Sa'di. And so this knowledge or this treasure is there, but it has to be extracted and brought out and repeated in the masajid and even upon the manabir and things like that. That's the general thing that the Shaykh was alluding to at the end, that we shouldn't really take this matter lightly, because this is the fitna of this time period. Just as shirk was the fitna among the people of Nuh today, this is the fitna, this taghrib and this ilhad, and pushing it all across the globe as a means of, you know, exploitation and whatever else. So in this respect, because that was the thing that we finished off at the end, I'm just going to give a few examples of the kind of thing that we can do to illustrate how we give tarbiyah to the children and how we bring out these evidences for Allah's rububiyah, for His wujud, for His existence. So an example here then is an example of Shaykh Islam Ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah. And he gives a beautiful example. He says that we have the eye, we have the mouth, and we have the ear. Within these three faculties, the eye, the mouth, and the ear, we find that there is moisture or fluid in each of these three faculties. There's moisture in the eye. There's moisture in the saliva in the mouth. And there is a type of fluid, like it's slightly thicker, but it's still a fluid and a type of moisture which is in the ear, which is the wax. So the Sheikh says that the eye of the water of the eye is salty. The water of the mouth is sweet. And the fluid of the ear is bitter. It's bitter. Why are these three fluids taking on different characteristics? How come they've taken on different characteristics? And he says there is a wisdom behind all of this. Right? The saltiness of the water in the eye is something that is protective of the eye. Right? It doesn't allow any bacteria or things of that nature to come and to rot away and to harm the eye itself. He says, this is the same wisdom why we see that the sea is salty. The sea is salty. Why is the sea salty? Because there is, he says, فَإِنَّ لَهُ سَبَبًا وَحِكْمَةً. His reason, the reason behind it is that it prevents the water from becoming rotten. And so it's that the fish and whatever else die in it, right? It will allow microorganisms to grow and expand so much that the whole, ecosystem, it just dies and everything perishes. So the water of the ocean has to be of a certain form. It is salty. And it derives that salt from what is on the earth. And then he says, had it not been for the saltiness, then the sea would have become rotten, then the air would become rotten above it, and this would then lead to disease and the corruption and harm upon the people. So this would be the environment and would be affected. It would affect everything. It says, as for the fluid in the ear, then it is bitter because that kills off any type of organism that might enter into it. That strong bitterness is going to make sure that it cannot enter and start growing and whatever else. And as for the fluid in the mouth, then it is sweet, so that when you eat, you basically get pleasure out of eating whatever food it is, because the sweetness, or whatever is, obviously it's enzymes, things like that, they mix with the food, and together it combines to provide the taste, and also to start the process of digestion. If Allah Azza wa Jalla had made the water of the mouth to be bitter, like what is in the ear, then a person would not really be able to eat food. And if he made the water of the ear to be sweet, then an organism could enter and it would feed off the sugars and the sweet and grow quicker, and then it would eventually enter into the passage and possibly go into the brain and things of that nature. So he says that when we look at all of these very specific things, we know that it cannot be any other way but this. It cannot be any other way but this. And there has to be a wisdom behind this. Similarly, we see that the eyes have not been put on the feet. Why are the eyes not on the feet? The eyes are on the head. They are on the highest point. And we see that the skin under the feet is very tough and very hard, as opposed to the skin in other places. And there's a specific reason for that, to enable walking and so on and so forth. And why are the eyes on the front of the head, not the back of the head? Right, so the point being, and he goes on, but the point being that when you look at an organism or a being, you see that there are very, very specific things about that organism which, there is a hikmah and there is a wisdom and there is a purpose behind it, and it couldn't have just happened just like that, right? You can see clearly there are intents and wisdom behind all of this. So what this shows us now, what this leads us to, is that this is a clear evidence of takhsis, of specification in a thing, and the irada which is behind it, and this clearly leads to, a khaliq, a creator, a knower, the one who made the specification, and this is something that is known by sound reason. There's nothing here that we've done wrong. It is pure sound reason, looking at observations and leading to the only conclusion. Right? So this is a clear. So this is something that you can tell your children. You can say, look, why is the mouth, the fluid in your mouth, why is it sweet? And why is the fluid in your eyes, why is it salty? Or why is the fluid in your ears, why is it bitter? Or sometimes you can taste the wax, it's really, really bitter. There's a wisdom behind this. And that is, you know, this is by design, this is by intent. And so, the point being, that these types of examples are so many in Allah's creation. Right? Everything in Allah's creation is an evidence for His existence. وَفِي كُلِّ شَيْءٍ لَهُ آيَةٍ تَدُلُّ عَلَى أَنَّهُ وَاحِدٍ. In every single thing, there is a sign for him, which indicates that he is one. So, now upon this, we see that the response of the, the atheists and those kind of people, Imam As-Sa'di, rahimahullah, he responds to those people, and he says about them, Sheikh As-Sa'di, he says, when he thinks and reflects about the statements of the Mulhideen and the Mahdiyeen, when you look at the atheists and the materialists, what they say, they claim that all of the events that are taking place, they are just things which happen in nature. Nature is what is creating. Nature is what is fashioning. Nature is what is producing. He says, but at the same time, according to them, nature has no awareness. It is not aware of anything. It doesn't have any knowledge. It doesn't have any direction. It doesn't have any objectives. It doesn't have any wisdoms. So nature is not even conscious. Right, it can't even have a concept of knowledge because it's just matter, it's nothingness. Right, so on the one hand, they want all of this to appear by nature, and on the one hand, they have to negate all of these qualities from nature. And the Shaykh is saying that this is, we see all of these tremendous wisdoms arising just purely out of blind, undirected forces of nature. And the Shaykh says that this is the one who reflects about what they are really saying, he will know that this saying resembles the aqwal of the majaneen, the people who are mad, the people who are insane. This is the saying of the insane people, whose intellects have been taken away from them. Right? And so again, the point being that what Imam As-Sa'di has alluded to here is that we put these evidences of Allah's rububiyyah and these day-to-day examples that people can relate to, we teach them and we inform the people of the insanity of what opposes this. Of the madness of what opposes this. Right? And we implant and we put this into the hearts and the minds of the people. Likewise, we see another example, another evidence from that is related from Al-Imam Ja'far As-Sadiq rahimahullah, which is found in some of the riwayat and the reports. And he was asked a question about Allah Azza wa Jal. So he was asked a question, and the questioner said, have you ever rowed on the ocean? Have you ever been on the ocean, on the sea? He said, yes. He said, have you ever experienced a moment when the strong, violent wind caused huge waves to come over you? And Ja'far, he said, yes, yes. And then the man said, in that situation, did you lose all hope of any assistance and any means of escaping? Did you come to the realization that there's absolutely no escape? There's no physical means I can use to escape from this huge wave that is going to envelope me and drown me. Did this pass through your heart? He said, قَالَ نَعَمْ. He said, yes. He said, then in this situation, did it pass through your mind? Did the thought pass through your mind that there has to be someone outside of these ways and means who is able to save you? Did you feel a hope, and did you have a thought in your heart that maybe, even though all of the physical ways and means that would be available to me are not present, did your heart still think and did it still pass through your mind that there is something or someone out there who is able to help me? And did your heart, was there some motion in your heart towards that thing, thinking to yourself, if only, and I hope, right? And he said, yes. He said, yes. And so Imam Ja'far said, فَذَلِكَ هُوَ
اللَّهُ. So that thing that your heart was seeking, right, that thing is Allah Azza wa Jal. Right, so this is one of the evidences, which is the evidences of fitra, that when a person, even an atheist or someone else, when he's in a calamity, right, and he realizes that all of the physical ways and means by which it might otherwise be possible for him. Let's give an example. So example, we have a building and there's a fire in the building and the fire is enveloping very, very rapidly, and at the top there's someone stuck there. Let's say he's an atheist, and you know, he realizes that every possible physical means by which I could have escaped are completely absent from me, right? So I don't have a parachute, I don't have a rope, I don't have, you know, some sort of, you know, any other means, right? I know all of that is gone. And as a matter of certainty, that fire is going to come and it's going to surround me, right? So he knows that the asbab, in terms of the possible worldly means, he knows that they are completely out of the picture, right? Now, in that situation, if there is a movement in his heart and these things go through his heart about, you know, there must be something, there has to be something, there must be someone or something that can save me. Now, even in his heart, if he's not thinking Allah or a creator, it doesn't have to be Allah the creator, because an atheist doesn't believe in a creator. But his heart, there's something in his heart that is trying to move towards something and put hope in something, or the thought passes through his mind that if only, or maybe, or this, whatever, that motion in his heart is a proof for the existence of Allah Azza wa Jal. Because if he was true to his belief, then that motion wouldn't be taking place in his heart, right? Because he would resign to the fact that, well, the asbab are cut off, let's just die. The asbab have gone, there's no other means, let's just die. But you find in all of these, many of these cases, these people are actually hoping and wishing and if and this and whatever, and that means that the heart is trying to move somewhere. It's trying to go towards somewhere. That heart is actually moving towards its creator, even though that person doesn't believe in a creator. Right? So this example here given by Ja'far As-Sadiq, rahimahullah, is another example. And again, this is something that you can actually teach to a child. Right? To put it in their minds that whenever you are in a calamity, you know, you turn your heart to Allah. This is what everybody does. And so you put this into their minds and you explain to them, you know, the wisdom and the reason behind that as well. And likewise, we can finish just a quick example from Ibn al-Qayyim rahimahullah, and this is a very good example of a type of evidence. This is in his book Al-Fawaid, and basically he says that the way Allah Azza wa Jal comes and he invites his servants to come and to know him, there are two ways to know him. The first is to look at his creations, and the second is to look into his verses in the Quran and to reflect upon them. These are two ways by which you come to know Allah, by which to come to know your Lord. Looking into the signs and then looking into the signs which are in the Quran. So those signs are the ones that we observe. And the signs in his book are the ones that we hear. So we're combining between observation and between what we hear. Right? Allah has invited us to look and to come to know him by these two ways, by the absar and by the asma, by the sam', by the hearing. And this is the way of the Quran. So the vision is what we see around us, the physical signs, and the hearing is what we see mentioned in the Quran. So we look and reflect upon what we see, and we hear and reflect upon what we hear of the heard verses of Allah Azza wa Jal. Then he expands upon the first type, what we see in Allah's creation. He says, فَأَمَّا الْمَفْعُولَاتِ فَإِنَّهَا دَالَةٌ عَلَى الْأَفْعَالِ, which means that the things that we see in Allah's creation, when we reflect upon them, what do they show? They show that certain actions have been performed. So, for example, we could give numerous examples, but let's say, for example, the sun and the precision of the sun and the motion of the sun, how within seconds, year in, year out, it is fixed, pretty much fixed, right? Meaning its course is pretty much fixed. just by observation, you know that that for the sun to be doing that and maintaining that motion, there has to be some prior action that has taken place, right? It can't be doing this of its own accord. And that precision in how it is moving, right, there has to be some prior action which has made it behave in the way that it has behaved, right? And the same thing can be applied to everything else. You can say, for example, let's look at a spider and an ant and a snake, for example. We see all of them, they behave in a very specific way. They behave in a very specific way. And what's making them behave in a very specific way? There must be something in some sort of guidance or some sort of programming in that spider, which is different to that which is in the ant, which is different to that which is in the snake, and likewise for every single animal, that they all behave in different ways. They all have different decision-making processes. They all have there must be something that's present, right? This is a clear evidence that certain actions have been performed to make them behave the way that they are behaving, right? So first of all, this is very clear from even this bottle. If I say the existence of this bottle gives clear evidence to the actions that were performed to bring this bottle to be the way it is, right? This maf'ul indicates the af'al. There is a maf'ul and there is a fi'l. This follows naturally, yes? Every produced thing, behind it there comes a fi'l, comes an action. This is a given. This is not even in dispute, right? So now we've come, from the object, we've moved one step backwards, and we've come to the af'al. There has to be actions that were performed in order to make that thing do what it does, or to follow the pattern that it does. Now from the af'al, from the actions, those af'al, wal af'al, dhalatun ala sifat. Those actions now indicate attributes. There has to be attributes, right? فَإِنَّ الْمَفْعُولَ يَدُلُّ عَلَى فَاعِلِ فِعْلِهِ وَذَلِكَ يَسْتَلْزِمُ وُجُودُهُ وَقُدْرَتُهُ وَمَشِيئَتُهُ وَعِلْمُهُ. So the action, then it necessitates the existence of the person who produced that thing, as well as him having power and will and knowledge. Power and will and knowledge. And this is because no action can take place except with these three attributes. No action can take place except with power, will, and knowledge. Right? So this bottle was not produced except that there was some action that had to take place. And an action cannot take place from anything unless it has power, will, and knowledge. Right? So once we've come to these attributes, this now is automatically a proof that there is a being who has knowledge, power, and will. It has to be, right? The only way you can deny this is to put these attributes somewhere else, right? So the only way to escape for an atheist would be to say, well, no, actually, is to put the attributes back into the bottle. You can't put them anywhere else. And that's what they're doing. When they speak about nature having a creative force, what they're really doing is they're putting these attributes into nature. They're saying, in reality, nature, yes, it designs, it creates, it knows what it's doing, it is going towards goals. So for example, the eye and the ear and the mouth and everything, nature must have some awareness and it creates those things, right? That's really what they are saying. But we know that this is a sign of madness to say that. So then they have to disguise and hide the fact that this is what they are doing. So then they start using very clever technical language to make it appear that they're not really saying this, but they are really saying this. Right? So they use very technical, cryptic, scientific language, right, to make it appear that that's not what they're saying. So there's only these two, and that's what Ibn al-Qayyim rahimahullah ta'ala is saying here, that you just take one object, and this clearly is evident. This is clearly evident. So the example I like to give to make this proof understandable is the example I gave the other day in the lesson, is that you see nowadays what these people are doing is that they are creating, they are creating drones, they are creating like combat combat animals. You might have seen this dog that they've made, which is able to go and engage in combat, right? Is able to fire bullets, is able to carry heavy load, and likewise they're building these like birds, mechanical birds, which they've programmed where they can fly in groups, right? So they have the remote control, and when they move like one bird, there's other birds around it, and through wireless, through Wi-Fi, through Bluetooth, they are able to make the other birds to move in unison. You might have seen this, you know, on the web. And they can move forward and back and down and whatever. And all the birds are moving collectively together, but by controlling only one bird, right? This is mimicking what you see some of the birds and what some of the fish do. There's some fish in the ocean that when sharks come, they all gather together in a thing. And you see amazingly that they all, how are they moving so swiftly all at the same time? It's amazing when you see this scene. So there's got to be some sort of communication that's passing between the water. There's got to be some wireless communication, and all of it's working in unison for them to, like, you know, they go like that, so the shark can't come and, you know, attack, right? So what they're doing is they are mimicking those behaviors in terms of this technology. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, what is it that's making this collection of metal and wires and bits of plastic and bits of glass, where's the intelligence, where's the decision-making process coming from when these things are not really intelligible? They haven't got any conscience. They are not able to think or decide. Where is that coming from? And that is coming from the program that has been put into that thing. Whether it's the drone, whether it's the, you know, the flying bird, whether it's the combat animal, right? Meaning that there's some intelligence that has come before that, which is based upon ilm and wisdom and qudra, and that bit has been put into that piece of metal that's making it behave the way it is. If you take that out, if you take that, you know, that hard drive or whatever else it out of it, will it do what it does? No. Now it's just become a piece of metal, it's become a piece of trash. It cannot do what it's supposed to do. When you put it back in, it will behave the way that it behaves, right? So once you understand this, you will realize this is actually the evidence in a modern way. It's the type of evidence that Musa al-Islam used against Fir'aun. Because in the dialogue between Musa and Fir'aun, Fir'aun said, وَمَنْ رَبُّكُمَا? Who is your Lord? And Musa al-Islam, he said, رَبُّنَا الَّذِي أَعْطَى كُلَّ شَيْءٍ خَلْقَهُ ثُمَّ هَدَى. Our Lord is the one who gave everything its form, and then He gave it its guidance. So the scholars, the Mufassirin, they explain this guidance here. What is the guidance? They say that Allah gave to every creature, He gave it its, like, He inspired it as to what its food is, what its habitat is, and its, what its zawj, its partner is. And He gave it something of aql that allows it to achieve that function. Right? So the spider has been given a certain amount of aql, right? Which is able to make decisions in terms of its food, drink, habitat, and its you know, spouse or whatever, yeah? So every animal is now different. It behaves in a different way, right? This now is the hidayah. This is from the ilm of Allah Azza wa Jal. He has put it in each of these creatures for them to behave in a certain way. There has to be ilm, right? Just like the physical examples I gave of the drone or whatever else, there is ilm that is driving these things, and that ilm came from outside of them. It came from outside of them. It didn't come from them themselves, right? So in a similar manner, in the creation of Allah, every single thing that we see is a sign for the existence of Allah. Why? Because it is evidence for His knowledge. I mean, just that in itself, you can make this argument very strongly and powerfully, which cannot be refuted, right? You say that every living thing, it operates upon ilm. That ilm is, you can go into the genetic code and the coding, whatever else, that is a clear evidence of the attribute of knowledge. You can't deny that, right? It's like if I showed you lines of code, you know, in Python, JavaScript, and some functions, and I said, this code does such and such. Does that indicate knowledge to you? You'd have to say yes.
The intent behind this function is, you know, to take two numbers and to return the multiplication or whatever else. This is a crude example. We can give more detailed examples of like file processing and encrypting and decrypting. This is what the function does, right? And then you show them, well, here is a genetic code, and this determines the hair color or the eye color or something else. Is there knowledge behind this? Right? If he says, no, there isn't, then he's a mubtil. Right, and straight away you know this man is a kadhab, he's a liar. This is bukabara. This is, you are now being arrogant in the face of the obvious. Right, you are in denial. How can you say here, this is there has to be ilm behind this? And how here you say, no, there's no ilm behind this. It is just a random whatever nature, whatever else. Right? This proves to you that this man is a safih and a majnoon. Because he's doing what Imam As-Sa'di said. His escape is to try and say, oh no, actually, this ilm here that you're trying to allude to, it's actually from nature. But hang on, nature is supposed to be unconscious, unaware, unintelligent, has no direction, is totally random, is totally blind. But your refuge is to try and pretend that it isn't. Alright? So here, this mulhid is exposed to that he is a kadhab and he's a liar. Just by that example on its own. So this is what Ibn al-Qayyim is basically alluding to. And the basis of this, you find it in the Qur'an, in the dialogue between Musa alayhi salam and Fir'aun. This is also repeated in Surah Al-A'la. وَالَّذِي خَلَقَ فَسَوَّى وَالَّذِي قَدَّرَ فَهَدَى. The one who created and fashioned and formed, and then who decreed and gave guidance. Ibn Kathir says that this ayah is the same as that one. In the story of Musa alayhi salam. So here then is another example you can present by way of tarbiyah, by way of establishing the dalail, the evidences for the wujud and the rububiyyah of Allah azza wa jal. And so this is just by way of illustration. We'll conclude with that this point inshallah ta'ala. We hope we've taken some benefit from the advice of Sheikh Saleh and from these examples that were given. If there are any questions related to the topic, inshallah, we'll try to address them, inshallah. Is there a link between veganism and atheism? It's not necessarily the case that the people who basically eat only vegetables. These people often come from the angle that it's cruel to kill animals. But this is not really connected to atheism. It's not driven by atheism. An atheist wouldn't really have reason to believe this, to believe that amongst the atheists, there are different, beliefs and philosophies. But in general, Allah knows best. I don't know that atheists would generally be drawn towards being vegans. So the answer to that, there is no like direct causal link between being a vegan and between atheism itself. Some of these vegans, they have like what they believe are moral reasons. They believe that it's murder to kill a lamb, to slaughter a lamb. It's murder, and they believe that we should change this. That we should this is unjust and we should change. So the way to answer these people is to tell them, well, let's take you to the safari in Africa, and we're going to leave you with the lions, and we want you to convince the lion not to kill the gazelle because it's murder, because it's unjust. And obviously we know that this person, so what this person is really doing is that they are denying the fundamental facts and realities of just life, right? It is from the fundamental facts and realities of life that that the sun and the rain and the soil and the air work together to produce vegetation. And the vegetation is food for the animals. Are we going to tell animals it's murder for you to kill a plant because a plant is still living? Anything which has biological life, it has a process of life, right? And so are you going to say it's murder now to kill the plant? Why do you go one step further and just become one who drinks only water? Because to kill a plant, something that's living, something that could have a conscience or whatever else, why are you killing plants? Why have you stopped the animals? So the plants now serve as food for the animals. And the animals then serve as food for humans. Right? There is an order, and things have been subjected for our benefit. Right? Just like if you go in the jungle, there's a law in the jungle. Right? Everything is subjected to something else, and there's a hierarchy and order. Right? So you are in denial of the fundamental facts and realities of, if you want to call it nature, right? You are in denial of that. Right? So, these people, because they don't have a belief often in Allah Azza wa Jal, so this is where the atheism thing could come in, because they don't have a belief in Allah Azza wa Jal, and because their morals and what they consider to be right and wrong is not hinged in factual reality, you'll see these people coming out with absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. They are in cloud cuckoo land. And that's why I said before in the lesson yesterday as well, that if you don't have your beliefs hinged in something, in the rububiyyah of Allah Azza wa Jal, where there are truths and realities, then you can start saying whatever you want. Right? You can wake up in the morning and pretend you are a woman. You can pretend you are a woman, and you can insist upon the people to address you as a woman. You can do that, right? Because you are ignoring the fundamental facts and realities of human nature. So Islam, Sharia, right? As Allah says, "Ala ya'lamu man khalaq." Should he not know who created? Right? So we are told of the realities of things, and upon that we have been given a legislation. If you ignore all of that, then you can come out with the most ridiculous, nonsensical things ever. Right? Which oppose actual reality. And so that's why you are getting these types of people who are appearing, you know, they're just lost, they're just wandering. They're not in any direction, and they, you know, they have these different philosophies and ideas. So some might turn into veganism. Some might, you know, start, you know, arguing for women's, you know, liberation and things like that. But they're ignoring the facts and realities. Why can't women have two husbands? Why can't women have four husbands? You know, so they are in denial of the fundamental facts. A woman is given 350 to 400. Over, right? Her fertility lasts 30-35 years, and at the age of 45-50, she'll be totally barren. Overwhelming, this is the reality of women. A man, he's able to produce sperm up until to his 90s and 100s, right? So either you accept that this is the fundamental facts and realities of human nature, and therefore understand and accept, yes, it is possible that a man may want to get married again above the age of 45-50, because he can. And why it doesn't make sense for a woman, you know, to have, you know, because her fertility is, you know, so we can bring these examples from the fundamental facts and realities of human nature and justify the ahkam and whatever else, right? Whereas these people are just living in cloud cuckoo land. They're not anchored in actual reality. And this happens when you believe that there isn't a khaliq and a mudabbir behind this universe. If you don't believe that, and you believe everything is just chaotic and random or whatever else, then whatever lifestyle you are going to choose and promote, it has to be based upon, it's going to be based upon chaos. It's going to lead to chaos eventually. Right? So these types of people, you'll find them, you know, appearing, but then they'll go into different things. So one will become like a vegan. Another one will become something else. Another one will become something else. And they're all just, you know, like these hippie people, the environment and Mother Earth and whatever else, right? They'll go into some weird fringe belief because it's not anchored in actual reality. Now, in some cases, we have to be just sometimes that their cause does have a basis. Like, for example, harming the environment and pollution and things like that. But then they'll take it to an extreme. Right? So because they can't see the masalih and the mafasid in things because it's not tied to, as I said, something that is sound about the creation of Allah, about the khalq of Allah Azza wa Jal. What is your advice on establishing a successful homeschool environment? Well, obviously this is connected to the topic, to the issues that we discussed earlier on, and this is a very, very
important question. These kind of issues will be looked at in detail, inshallah ta'ala, in the conference in December in the Salafi Masjid at the end of this month, inshallah ta'ala. The whole theme is specifically about this, basically about the youth, about children, about upbringing. So I advise you, for a detailed elaboration and study, attend that conference for that purpose. But in general, first of all, again, this might not apply to every household, but these are some of the things that you can establish. First of all, dedicate a specific room or a specific area of the house, and if not, then use the kitchen table or something. But have a specific area where your children, where they know that at set times, they, you know, do their studies, and they meet together, and they sit there, and you sit there with them, and, you give them tarbiyah, you make them establish a daily routine, and so that routine starts with things like a basic lesson, a basic daily lesson on just a simple 5-10 minute lesson on something to do with the Tawheed of Allah Azza wa Jal, or about being sincere, or about explaining the dhikr, or one of the supplications. Something practical on that basis, that you give them something like that on a daily basis. Then you teach them adab, like ways of behaving, how they have to behave with the parents, how they behave with the siblings, how they behave with the grandparents, how they behave with the imam in the masjid, how they behave with other Muslims, right? Because the adab is extremely important, that their behavior, that they're able to behave in a manner where they are respected, that these are respectful children who know how to interact with other people, right? Know how to speak with other people. So these are just tarbiyah type things to do with the character. As for the actual contents and the materials of the lessons, you have to give them something in aqidah and tawheed. You have to give them something in aqidah and tawheed. So you choose certain books like Al-Qawaid al-Arba, or something simple, the three principles. Choose explanations. Maybe many of the students of knowledge have given explanations on cassette or something. You sit there, you make them go through those lessons. So you have to address Tawheed and Aqeedah as a routine, as a regular part of the homeschool. And then you choose other things which they have to learn because we are in the environment that we're in. Things like maths, things like make them reading, make them read books, make them aware of. Now this is an important point. Do not close your children off to the degree that they are totally oblivious to the environment that is around them. Right? This is a danger that we have now, because sometimes we might try to be overly protective such that they become oblivious to the realities of the society that they are living in. And they can't cope with that society, which means that to some degree or other, you have to inform them of the nature of the society that they are living in, things which are happening around them, right? And, that they're at least aware of what's happening and what's what. So they've got some level of intelligence and understanding of what's actually going on, right? So you can't close them completely off. And so to that extent, maybe you sit down and you take something that's happening in the news or some event, right? No, I'm not saying you sit them down, but I'm saying you take some issue or event. You say, oh, yes, there's actually a war in Yemen taking place right now, and this is what's going on. There is the Rafida, and they are trying to commit revolutions in the Sunni Muslim lands because they are waiting for their imam. And what those Muslim countries are trying to do, the Gulf countries, they're trying to repel. And obviously, in history, we know that, as Ibn Taymiyyah told us, that the Rafida, always the ally, and they collude, with the Munafiqeen and the Kufar and whatever else, in order to attack the Sunni Muslims. This is from their history. So what I'm saying is that you can't just make them oblivious to the things which are happening either in that society or just generally around the world as a whole. So you keep them up to date, you keep them informed, you allow them to gain an understanding, a working understanding of the world, so that they know what's going on, right? And they can make sense of the things which are going on around them. So, obviously, I know that the answer to this question, we can go on and on and on and on, and we can speak about a curriculum, we can speak about, but I'm giving you some of the things which are maybe not often mentioned, which are often forgotten, you know, when we try to home educate our children. Fourthly, obviously, you have to be an example yourself. So you have to be an example of a person, you know, who is serious about knowledge, who is reading books. So if you read books and you tell your children, you know, today I read 2 books and this is what the books were about. Right? Make them read a book and make them tell you what did they learn from the book. What have they read? Whether it's fiction, whether it's non-fiction, sometimes kids, especially who are younger, maybe they like to read, you know, stories. You choose the stories that they read and then let them tell you what did you learn from this, you know, whatever. So you be an example if you are someone who spends time reading, studying, and then they will follow that example as well. Inculcate within them the desire to want to read and explore and to, you know, acquire knowledge and whatever else, then this will follow through on them as well. So the point being, this is a long answer. I suggest you come to this conference, inshallah ta'ala, and the whole of the conference will be based around this specific thing. And Allah knows best. So inshallah we'll conclude our lesson there. We'll stop now. If you want to make wudu for the salah, which is due shortly, then do so. والحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على نبينا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين